All right, so you ready to jump into this? You sent over this incredible set of slides about weather theory, and wow, looks like we've got someone prepping for a big lesson, maybe brushing up for some flight training, or maybe just someone who really loves a good meteorological mystery.
It's all fascinating
It
stuff.
really is. So whatever the reason, get ready because today we are diving deep into the atmosphere and all the wild weather it throws at us.
You know what always gets me about the atmosphere?
Yeah.
It's this massive, or like seemingly endless when you look up at the sky, but when you really break it down, it's mostly made up of just four gases.
Seriously.
Yeah, we're talking nitrogen, oxygen, argon, and carbon dioxide. Just those four make up almost 99.998% of what we think of as air.
Wow. I always picture the atmosphere as this, like, I don't know, complex cocktail of elements, you know, like some kind of cosmic soup or something. But okay, four main gases. So is it the same mix everywhere, like from where we are now all the way up to where like satellites are hanging out?
That's where it gets even more interesting. Think of it more like a layer cake than a soup.
Okay, a layer cake.
Yeah, you've got five distinct layers, each with its own unique kind of personality. The troposphere, stratosphere, mesosphere, thermosphere, and finally the exosphere. And each one's not just different in terms of what it's made of, but also, how it moves, how dense it is, and even how hot or cold it gets.
A lot going on up there.
Yeah.
All right, so let's break this cake down layer by layer, starting with the one we know best. The troposphere. What's happening down here in Weather Central?
Well, the troposphere is our home turf.
Yeah.
Literally, this is where we live, breathe, and experience all that crazy weather. It stretches up to around 36,000 feet.
Higher than Mount Everest.
Way higher, yeah. And down here, we get rain, snow, fog, those amazing puffy white clouds on a summer day. It's all happening in the troposphere. And here's something interesting about this layer. The higher you go, the thinner the air gets, and the colder the temperature.
Right, which makes sense because, you know, mountain climbers bundle up to stay warm up there. So that's the troposphere, our weather playground. Okay, what about that next level up? The stratosphere.
The stratosphere.
Yeah, doesn't that have something to do with airplanes?
It does. Have you ever been on a long-haul flight and felt that sudden smooth out after some initial bumps?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You probably cruised right into the stratosphere. That's where commercial airliners like to hang out because it's above most of the turbulent weather.
Makes sense.
It extends up to about 31 miles and actually holds a surprising amount of the atmosphere's gases. We're talking 19%, but almost no water vapor.
So that's the secret to those overpriced mini pretzels and tomato juice they give you on the plane. Dry, stable air. Come on, there has to be some kind of trade-off for all that smooth sailing, or right?
Right on. The higher you go in the stratosphere, the more fuel you burn because of the thinner air. And get this, the temperature actually increases with altitude, thanks to the sun's ultraviolet radiation.
Really? So it gets hotter the higher you go. Interesting. So smooth ride, but you pay for it in fuel and maybe pack some extra sunscreen. Okay, now I've always been curious about those other layers, the mesosphere, thermosphere, and exosphere. They sound kind of mysterious and maybe even a little intimidating. What's the deal with those?
They're definitely more out there, but equally fascinating. Think of the mesosphere as kind of a transitional layer. It goes up to about 53 miles, and like the troposphere, the air gets thinner and colder as you climb. Above that is where things get really wild, the thermosphere. This layer extends a mind-blowing 430 miles above Earth. And get this, the temperature near the top can reach a scorching 2,000 degrees Celsius.
2,000 degrees, isn't that like hotter than molten lava? Wouldn't you just be instantly vaporized up there?
Not so fast. Even though the temperature's incredibly high up there, the air molecules are so far apart that there's very little heat transfer. So it wouldn't feel anywhere near as hot as you might think.
Oh, okay. So it's more like a theoretical hotness.
Yeah.
Fascinating. And lastly, we have the exosphere, the final frontier.
The exosphere is the ultimate boundary. It stretches a mind-boggling 6,200 miles out, gradually fading into the vacuum of space. Up here, atoms and molecules can actually escape Earth's gravity and just drift off. This is where many satellites orbit Earth.
Wow. So we've got this layered atmosphere, this mix of gases, and some pretty extreme temperatures going on. But how do we go from this to like the actual weather we experience down here on Earth?
That's where things get really dynamic. We've got to talk about pressure systems and wind. You see, differences in air pressure are the engine behind the wind. It all comes down to how air likes to move from areas of high pressure to areas of low pressure.
Okay, pressure systems. I remember those from like, you know, grade school, but it always seemed kind of abstract to me. What's the real world impact of these pressure differences? How does that translate into the weather we see every day?
Think of it this way. You've got these areas of high pressure and they're kind of like antsy. They want to move into those areas of low pressure just to try and even things out. And that movement, that flow of air trying to equalize, that's what we call wind.
Oh, okay. So it's like nature's way of balancing things out. It's constantly trying to achieve some sort of equilibrium. But it's not just a straight shot from high to low pressure, is it? I mean, there are other things that influence how the wind blows, right?
You're absolutely right. There are actually three main forces that get the wind moving and grooving. Pressure gradient force, the Coriolis effect, and friction.
Okay, let's break those down. Let's start with that first one, pressure gradient force. This sounds exactly like what we were just talking about.
It is. It really is. The bigger the difference in pressure between those two points, the high and the low, the steeper that pressure gradient. And the steeper the gradient, the faster the air rushes in to fill that void.
Meaning the stronger the wind.
Exactly. Think of it like rolling a ball down a hill. The steeper the hill, the faster that ball is going to go, right?
Right. Okay. That makes sense. So high pressure is like the top of the hill. Mm. Low pressure is the bottom. And the wind is that ball just rolling downhill. What about this Coriolis effect, though? That one sounds a little more, I don't know, complex.
It definitely is a bit mind-bending. The Coriolis effect is all about how the Earth's rotation influences things that are moving across long distances over its surface.
Wait, are you saying the spinning of the Earth affects which way the wind blows?
That's exactly what I'm saying. Because the Earth is spinning, anything that travels long distances over its surface, like wind, gets deflected. And in the Northern Hemisphere, that deflection is to the right. So the wind traveling from high to low pressure doesn't just go in a straight line, it curves.
Hold on, so that means like hurricanes in the Northern Hemisphere, they spin counterclockwise because of this Coriolis effect.
You got it. It's not just some random spin cycle. It's the Earth's rotation that plays this huge role in how those massive storms actually develop.
Wow. I always thought that was just a hurricane thing, not a plant spin thing.
So cool. Okay, so we've got these pressure gradients that are creating that initial push, and then we've got the Coriolis effect, kind of like adding a curveball to the whole thing. What about friction? I feel like that one might be a little more straightforward. Yeah, you're right. Friction is that force that tries to slow things down. And in this case, it's all about the air rubbing against the Earth's surface.
Okay, so we're talking like trees, buildings, mountains.
Exactly. All those things create friction and they slow that wind down, especially near the ground.
So the next time I feel a breeze on my face, I'll be picturing pressure differences, a spinning planet, and maybe a tree or two kind of getting in the way of things. This is fascinating. Okay, but let's move on to another crucial weather factor, temperature.
Temperature. Temperature is all about energy, specifically the average kinetic energy of the molecules in a substance. Basically, the hotter something is, the faster those molecules are vibrating and moving around.
Okay, so like this steaming cup of coffee I'm holding, those molecules are having a wild dance party compared to, say, an ice cube.
Exactly. And that heat, that energy can be transferred in three main ways: radiation, conduction, and convection.
Right. Let's break those down. I know radiation has something to do with the sun.
It does. Radiation is the transfer of heat through electromagnetic waves like those coming from the sun.
It's how the Earth gets warmed up.
Exactly.
And the conduction is like direct contact, right? Mm-hmm. Like when I accidentally touch a hot stove out.
You got it. Conduction is heat transfer through touch. Now, convection is a little bit more complex. Convection involves the movement of fluids.
Fluids.
Fluids like air or water.
So like a lava lamp. The hot wax rises, cools down, and sinks, creating that mesmerizing flow.
Perfect example. That's convection in action. Heat transfer through the movement of fluids.
I love that. Okay, so we've got these three ways that heat can be transferred. But what about the water that falls from the sky? I mean, how do we go from invisible water vapor to rain, snow, sleet, all those fun forms of precipitation?
To get precipitation, you need a few key ingredients. First, you need moisture in the air, that invisible water vapor.
Makes sense.
Second, you need something to lift that moist air upwards, which causes it to cool down. And finally, those tiny water droplets that form need to grow big enough that they can actually fall as precipitation.
So it's not just enough to have clouds, because clouds are just water vapor, right?
That's right. Not all clouds produce precipitation. You know those fluffy cumulus clouds on a sunny day?
Oh, yeah.
Those are full of tiny little water droplets, but those droplets are way too small and light to actually fall as rain.
So how do they bulk up? How do those tiny droplets become like the rain that I'm always caught without an umbrella for?
Think of it like a giant mosh pit inside that cloud, a water droplet mosh pit. As these droplets get jostled around by air currents within the cloud, they collide and they combine and they get bigger and bigger until they're finally heavy enough to fall as rain.
So it's a combination of moisture lift and then a raindrop mosh pit that leads to a downpour.
Got it. But what about snow, sleet, and freezing rain? Those are different forms of frozen water, right?
You're right. Those forms of precipitation really depend on something called the temperature profile of the atmosphere, basically how the temperature changes with height.
Okay, so if it's below freezing all the way from the cloud down to the ground, we get snow. Exactly, snow all the way. Now, sleet, or ice pellets, as they're sometimes called, that's where things get interesting. Imagine a snowflake falling from the cloud, right?
Okay, I'm picturing it.
It hits a layer of slightly warmer air.
So it starts to melt a little.
Right, but then as it keeps falling, it falls through another layer of below freezing air closer to the surface and freezes solid again before it hits the ground. And what you get are these tiny little icy pellets instead of those fluffy snowflakes.
So it's like a snowflake that briefly considered becoming a raindrop, but then was like, nope, I'm going full ice pellet. What about freezing rain? That one's a nightmare on the roads.
Freezing rain is similar to sleet, but that layer of warm air is much shallower, so the raindrops don't actually have enough time to refreeze completely before they hit the ground. So they hit the surface as super-cooled liquid water, but then they freeze instantly on contact. That creates that treacherous icy glaze that we all know and love.
So snow needs it to be cold all the way down. Sleet needs that warm layer followed by a cold layer, and freezing rain needs just a tiny little layer of cold air at the bottom.
Yeah.
Got it. This is making so much more sense to me now.
It's all about those layers.
It really is. Speaking of layers and boundaries, we often hear about cold fronts and warm fronts on the weather report. What exactly is a front?
A front is essentially a battleground between two very different air masses, one warm, one cold.
It's a weather turf war.
Yeah.
So what happens when these air masses collide?
That's when things get really interesting. You see, the type of weather you get really depends on how these air masses interact. Cold fronts, those are kind of like the bulldozers of the weather world.
They just like barge in and push everything else out of the way.
Pretty much. A cold front has a really steep slope, and it forces that warmer air upwards very quickly. That rapid lifting can create some dramatic weather. Heavy downpours, strong winds, and even sometimes thunderstorms.
So if I see a cold front on the map, be prepared for some weather drama.
Exactly. Now, warm fronts are definitely more subtle. They have a gentler slope.
Okay.
So the warm air rises more gradually over that cooler air. And this usually results in more widespread cloud cover and lighter, steadier precipitation.
So instead of that sudden downpour, maybe more like a light drizzle or a bit of mist.
Exactly. It's all about how those air masses decide to interact.
Okay. So we've got our colliding air masses, our fronts. But let's shift gears for a minute and talk about those, I don't know, cotton candy-like wonders in the sky. Clouds. There are so many different types of clouds. How do we even begin to make sense of all those different shapes and formations?
Well, clouds are classified based on their altitude and their general appearance. Think of it like a three-story building.
Okay, a three-story building.
You've got low-level clouds hanging out near the ground, then your mid-level clouds kind of in the middle, and then high-level clouds way up high.
And each floor of this cloud building has its own, like, residents, right? Like those wispy cirrus clouds that look like brush strokes across the sky.
Exactly. Cirrus clouds are those high altitude beauties typically found above 20,000 feet. They're made up mostly of ice crystals, and they often signal fair weather. Then you have your big fluffy cumulus clouds that look like cotton balls. Those are your classic low-level clouds, often associated with fair weather as well.
And what about those ominous gray sheets of clouds that seem to blanket the entire sky?
Those are your stratus clouds. They hang out in the low to mid-levels and are often associated with overcast skies and sometimes drizzle or light rain.
Okay, so we've got the wispy cirrus, the puffy cumulus, and those flat gray stratus clouds. And I'm guessing those are just a few of the many cloud varieties out there.
Oh, there are many more. We've got altostratus clouds, which are mid-level clouds that can create those beautiful halos around the sun or moon. And then there are the cumulonimbus clouds. Those are the rock stars of the cloud world.
The rock stars, I have a feeling those aren't your average, you know, fluffy white cloud.
Not at all. Cumulonimbus clouds are thunderstorm clouds. They're those towering giants that can reach incredible heights, sometimes all the way from the low levels to the top of the troposphere.
Thunderstorms. Okay, now we're talking. I am always in awe of those powerful storms. What exactly causes a thunderstorm to ignite?
It's like baking a cake, but instead of flour and sugar, we're using heat and moisture. To cook up a thunderstorm, you need a specific mix of ingredients.
I'm intrigued. What goes into this stormy recipe?
First off, you need a good amount of moisture in the air. That's the fuel for our storm.
Okay, moisture check. What else?
Then you need unstable air, you know, the kind that's just itching to rise, ready to rumble. And lastly, you need a trigger, something to give that warm, moist air a little nudge upwards.
A trigger, like a weather match, striking up a storm. What could cause that kind of lift?
Lots of things, actually. A front moving through, where you've got warm air being forced to rise over colder air, that's a classic trigger. Or even uneven heating of the Earth's surface can do it.
Oh, right. Like how a parking lot gets way hotter than, say, a grassy field on a sunny day.
Exactly. That difference in heating creates updrafts, those rising columns of air, and that can kickstart that whole thunderstorm process.
So we've got this warm, humid air just kind of hanging out, and then boom, something gives it a nudge and things get intense. Mm-hmm. What happens next?
So as that warm, moist air rises, it starts to cool down and it condenses, forming those towering cumulonimbus clouds we were talking about earlier.
The rock stars.
The rock stars, exactly. And inside these clouds, it's a whirlwind of activity. You've got powerful updrafts and downdrafts. You've got water droplets freezing into ice crystals. And static electricity is building up like crazy.
And that static electricity, that's what eventually leads to that incredible crackle of lightning, right?
You got it. When that electrical potential difference between the cloud and the ground, or even within different parts of the cloud, gets large enough sap, it discharges and you get that flash of lightning. And that bolt of lightning, it heats the air around it so rapidly that it basically explodes outwards, creating a shockwave. And that's the thunder we hear.
So the lightning is the flash and the thunder is the boom wow.
Yeah.
It's amazing how much energy is packed into a single thunderstorm. But there's more to it than just the lightning and thunder, right? What other hazards come along with these storms?
Oh, thunderstorms are like the multi-tool of hazardous weather. We're talking heavy rain that can lead to flash flooding, hail that can be the size of golf balls, or even larger, yikes. And then there are those dangerous downdrafts you might have heard of.
Microbursts.
Microbursts. Those sound intense. What exactly are those?
Imagine someone pointing a fire hose straight down at the ground.
Yeah.
That's kind of what a microburst is like. It's the sudden, powerful downdraft of air that hits the ground and spreads out horizontally with incredible force.
How powerful are we talking? We're talking winds that can reach over 100 knots.
100 knots. That's faster than some hurricanes. I can definitely see why those would be dangerous.
Especially for aircraft during takeoff and landing. Those sudden wind shifts can be extremely difficult to recover from. Pilots are trained extensively to recognize and avoid those microbursts.
It's incredible how many different dangers can be lurking inside these storms.
Mm.
Are there any other hazards we should be aware of?
Well, we've got turbulence, of course, those bumpy, stomach-churning rides that thunderstorms are known for. And then there's icing. Inside a thunderstorm, you can have these super-cooled water droplets.
Super-cooled. What does that mean?
It means they can remain liquid even when the temperature is below freezing. And when those droplets hit an aircraft, they freeze on contact, which, as you can imagine, can create some major issues for flight.
And so even if it's relatively warm on the ground, up in those clouds, it's a whole different story. Okay, I think we can all agree, giving thunderstorms a wide berth is probably the best policy.
Without a doubt. Now, speaking of reduced visibility, we can't forget about fog.
Fog. It's like a cloud decided to take a nap at ground level, and it always seems to roll in at the worst possible time. What causes these mysterious blankets of white to just engulf everything in sight?
Fog forms when the air near the ground cools down to what's called its dew point. You see, the air around us can only hold a certain amount of moisture, and as that air cools down, its capacity to hold that moisture decreases.
And when it can't hold any more moisture,
that's when the magic happens. That excess water vapor condenses into these teeny tiny little water droplets that hang suspended in the air, and voila, you've got fog.
So simple, yet so disruptive. What are some of the different ways that fog can form? Because I feel like I've seen it happen in all sorts of situations.
You're right. Fog is quite the chameleon of the weather world. One of the most common types is radiation fog, which tends to form on clear, calm nights. So as the ground cools down, it chills the air that's right above it, causing that air to reach its dew point.
That's why you often wake up to fog on those crisp autumn mornings.
Precisely. And then, of course, as the sun climbs higher, the ground warms up and that fog magically burns off. Then you've got what's called advection fog, which forms when warm, moist air moves horizontally over a colder surface.
Like those classic scenes of fog rolling in over the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco.
Exactly. The cold water of the Pacific Ocean cools down that warm, moist air that's flowing in from the west, creating those really iconic fog banks.
So cool. Okay, so we've got radiation fog, advection fog.
Yeah.
Any other types of fog we should be on the lookout
You've
for?
got upslope fog, which happens when moist, stable air is forced upwards as it travels up a slope, kind of like a cloud that hasn't quite made it off the ground yet.
Okay.
And then there's steam fog.
That one sounds kind of magical, like something out of a movie.
Steam fog is definitely dramatic. It happens when you have really cold, dry air passing over a much warmer body of water.
So picture like a frigid winter day with icy air blowing across a relatively warm lake or river.
Exactly. And you'll often see these wisps of fog rising from the surface, almost as if the water itself is steaming. It's really quite a sight.
That's amazing. This deep dive in the fog has been eye-opening. Who knew there were so many different ways to create those mystical blankets of white?
And fog is just one of many fascinating weather phenomena that remind us of how incredible and complex our atmosphere truly is.
We've covered so much ground today, from the structure of the atmosphere to the forces that drive wind to the dynamics of thunderstorms. I feel like I've gained a whole new appreciation for the science behind the weather we experience every single day.
And remember, this is just a glimpse into the vast and ever-changing world of meteorology. There's always something new to learn, something new to explore.
Absolutely. So to our listeners, keep looking up, stay curious, and never stop exploring the wonders of our atmosphere. That's a wrap on our deep dive into weather theory.